said Christina. You were there when the fairy convoy was speaking to Arthur in the sanctuary. He tilted his face toward hers. There was a scar across the side of his neck, not the mark of a vanished rune, but a raised welt. His hair was untidy and looked as if it had been uncut for months, years even. The curling white tips touched his shoulders. Do you trust them? The fairies? Christina shook her head. Good. He looked away from her. You shouldn't. He reached for the cardboard box that Ty had left on the floor and pulled it toward him. What is this? Things they thought you might want, Christina said. Your brothers and sisters. Gifts of welcome, said Mark in a puzzled tone, and knelt down by the box, removing a hodgepodge of odd items. Some t-shirts and jeans that were probably Julian's, a microscope, bread and butter, a handful of desert wildflowers from the garden behind the institute. Mark raised his head to look at Christina. His eyes glittered with unshed tears. His shirt was thin and ragged. She could see through the material, see other welts and scars on his skin. What do I say to them? To who? My family. My brothers and sisters, my uncle. He shook his head. I remember them, and yet I don't. I feel as if I have lived here all my life, and yet I've also always been with the Wild Hunt. I hear the roar of it in my ears, the call of the horns, the sound of the wind. It overpowers their voices. How do I explain that? Don't explain it, said Christina softly. Just say you love them and you miss them every day. Tell them you hated the Wild Hunt. Tell them you're glad to be back. But why would I do that? Won't they know I'm lying? Didn't you miss them? Aren't you glad to be back? I don't know, he said. I cannot hear my heart or what it tells me. I can only hear the wind. Before Christina could reply, a sharp tap came at the window. It rattled again, a pattern of taps that sounded almost like a code. Mark sprang to his feet. He crossed the room to the window and flung it open, leaning out. When he ducked back in, there was something in his hand. An acorn. Christina's eyes widened. Acorns were one of the ways fairies sent messages to each other. Hidden in leaves, flowers, and other wild things. Already? She said, unable to help it. They couldn't leave him, even for this long, alone with his family and his home. Looking pale and strained, Mark crushed the acorn in his fist. A twist of pale parchment fell out. He caught it and read the message silently. His hand opened. He slid to the floor, pulling his knees up against his chest, dropping his head in his hands. His long, pale hair fell forward as the parchment fluttered to the ground. A low sound issued from his throat, halfway between a groan and a wail of pain. Christina picked up the parchment. On it was written in a delicate script, Remember your promises. Remember that none of it is real. Fire to water, said Emma as they sped down the highway toward the Institute. After all these years, I finally know what some of those markings mean. Julian was driving. Emma had her feet propped on the dashboard, her window down, the sea-softened air filling the car and lifting the light hair around her temples. This was how she'd always ridden in cars with Julian, with her feet up and the wind in her hair. It was something Julian loved, Emma beside him in the car, driving with the blue sky overhead and the blue sea to the west. It was an image that felt full of infinite possibility, as if they could simply keep driving forever, the horizon their only destination. It was a fantasy that played out sometimes when he was falling asleep, that he and Emma packed their things into the trunk of a car and left the Institute, in a world where he had no children and there was no law and no Cameron Ashdown, where nothing held them back but the limits of their love and imagination. And if there were two things he believed were limitless, it was love and imagination. It does sound like a spell, Julian said, wrenching his mind back to the present moment. He revved the engine, the wind rushing in through Emma's window as they gathered speed. Her hair lifted, pale corn silk spilling out from the neatness of her braids, making her look young and vulnerable. But why would the spell be recorded on the bodies? Emma asked. The thought of anything hurting her made an ache form inside his chest. And yet he was hurting her. He knew it and hated it. He believed he'd had such a brilliant idea when he thought of taking the children to England for 8 weeks. Knowing Christina Rosales was coming, knowing Emma wouldn't be alone or unhappy, it had seemed perfect. He'd thought things would be different when he came back, that he would be different. But he wasn't. What did Magnus say to you? he asked as she looked out the window, her scarred fingers drumming in a rhythmic tattoo on her bent knee. He whispered something. A furrow appeared between her brows. He said that there are places where ley lines converge. I assume he means that since they bend and curve, there are locations where more than one of them meet, maybe all of them. And that's important because... She shook her head. I don't know. We do know all the bodies have been dumped at ley lines, and that's a specific kind of magic. Maybe the convergences have some quality we need to understand. We should find a map of ley lines. I bet Arthur would know where to look in the library. If not, we can find it ourselves. Good. Good? She sounded surprised. It's going to take a few days for Malcolm to translate those papers, and I don't want to spend those days sitting around the Institute staring at Mark, waiting for him to... Waiting. It's better if we keep working, have something to do. His voice sounded stretched thin to his own ears. He hated it, hated any visible or audible sign of weakness. Though at least it was only with Emma, who he could show these things to. Emma, alone in his life, did not need his caretaking, did not need him to be perfect or perfectly strong. Before Julian could say anything else, Emma's phone went off with a loud buzz. She pulled it out of her pocket. Cameron Ashdown. She frowned at the llama on the screen. Not now, she told it, and shoved the phone back into her jeans. Are you going to tell him? Julian asked, and heard the stiffness in his own voice and hated it. About all of this? About Mark? I would never tell. Never. He kept his grip on the wheel tight, his jaw set. You're my parabatai, she said, and now there was anger in her voice. You know I wouldn't. Julian slammed on the brakes. The car lurched forward, the wheel slewing out of his hands. Emma yelped as they skidded off the road and bumped down into a ditch by the side of the highway, in between the road and the dunes over the sea. Dust was rising up around the car in plumes. Julian whirled toward Emma. She was white around the mouth. Jules. I didn't mean it, he said. She stared. What? You being my parabatai is the best thing in my life, Julian said. The words were steady and simple, spoken without a trace of anything held back. He'd been holding back so tightly that the relief of it was almost unbearable. Impulsively, she undid her safety belt, rising up in her seat to look down on him solemnly. The sun was high overhead. Up close, he could see the gold lines inside the brown of her eyes, the faint spatter of light freckles across her nose, the bits of lighter, sun-bleached hair mixed with the darker hair at her nape. Raw umber and Naples yellow mixed with white. He could smell rose water on her and laundry detergent. She leaned into him, and his body chased the feeling of closeness, of having her back and near. Her knees bumped against his. But you said... I know what I said, he turned toward her, slewing his body around in the driver's seat. While I was away, I realized some things. Hard things. Maybe I even realized them before I left. You can tell me what they are. She touched his cheek lightly. He felt his whole body lock into tension. I remember what you said about Mark last night, she went on. You were never the oldest brother. He always was. If he hadn't been taken, if Helen had been able to stay, you would have made different choices because you would have had someone to take care of you. He breathed out. Emma. Raw pain. Emma, I said what I said because sometimes I think I asked you to be my parabatai because I wanted you to be tied to me. The consul wanted you to go to the academy, and I couldn't stand the thought. I'd lost so many people, I didn't want to lose you, too. She was so close to him, he could feel the heat from her sun-warmed skin. For a moment she said nothing, and he felt as if he were on the gallows, having the hangman's noose fastened around his throat, waiting only for the drop. Then she put her hand over his on the console between them. Their hands. Hers were delicate-looking, but more scarred than his own, more calloused, her skin rough against his. His sea-glass bracelet glowed like jewels in the sunlight. People do complicated things because people are complicated, she said. All that stuff about how you're supposed to make the parabatai decision only for totally pure reasons, that's a crock. I wanted to tie you to me, he said, because I was tied here. Maybe you should have gone to the academy. Maybe it would have been the right place for you. Maybe I took something away from you. Emma looked at him, Her face was open and completely trusting. He almost thought he could feel his convictions shatter, the convictions he'd built up before he'd left at the beginning of the summer, the convictions he'd carried with him all the way back home until the moment he'd seen her again. He could feel them breaking inside him like driftwood shattered against rocks. "Jules," she said, "you gave me a family. You gave me everything." A phone shrilled again. Emma's. Jillian sat back, heart pounding, as she thumbed it out of her pocket. He watched as her face set. "Livy's texting," she said. "She says Mark woke up, and he's screaming." Jillian floored the car on the way home, Emma keeping her hands clasped around her knees as the speedometer crept up past 80. They careened into the parking lot behind the Institute and slammed on the brakes. Jillian threw himself out of the car and Emma raced after him. They reached the second floor to find the younger Blackthorne seated on the floor outside Mark's door. Drew was curled up with Tavi against Livy's side. Ty sat alone, his long hands dangling between his knees. They were all staring. The door was cracked partway open, and through it, Emma could hear Mark's voice raised and angry, and then another voice, lower and more soothing. Christina. "Sorry I texted," said Livy in a small voice. "It's just that he was screaming and screaming." He finally stopped, but Christina's in there with him. If any of the rest of us go in, he howls and yells. "Oh, my God." Emma moved toward the door, but Jillian caught her, swinging her around to face him. She looked over and saw that Ty had begun to rock back and forth, his eyes closed. It was something he did when things were too much, too loud, too harsh, or hard, or fast, or painful. The world was extra intense for Ty, Jillian had always said. It was as if his ears could hear more clearly, his eyes see more, and sometimes it was too much for him. He needed to cover noise, to feel something in his hand to distract him. He needed to rock back and forth to soothe himself. "Everyone processed stress in a different way," Jillian said. "This was Ty's, and it hurt nobody." "Em," Jillian said, his face was taut, "I need to go in alone." She nodded. He let go of her almost reluctantly. "Guys," he said, looking at his siblings, at Drew's round, worried face, Tavi's uncomprehending one, Livy's unhappy eyes, and Ty's hunched shoulders. "It's going to be hard for Mark. We can't expect him to be okay all at once. He's been away a long time. He has to get used to being here." "But we're his family," said Livy. "Why would you have to get used to your own family?" "You might," Jillian said in that patient, soft voice that amazed Emma sometimes. "If you'd been away from them a long time, and you'd been somewhere where your mind plays tricks on you." "Like Fairy," said Ty. He had stopped rocking and was leaning back against the wall, dark hair damp on his face. "Right," said Jillian. "So we're going to have to give him time. Maybe leave him alone a little." He looked over at Emma. She pasted a smile on her face. God, she was so much worse at this than Jules. And said, "Malcolm's working on the investigation. The murders. I thought we could head to the library and look into ley lines." "Me too," Drusilla piped up. Emma said, "You can help us plot a map, okay?" Drew nodded. "Okay." She rose to her feet and the others followed. As Emma led them away down the hall, a quietly subdued group, she looked back only once. Jillian was standing by the door to Mark's room watching them go. His eyes met hers for a split second before he looked away, as if he hadn't seen her glance at all. If only Emma was with him, Jillian thought as he pushed open the door, this would be easier. It would have to be easier. When Emma was with him, it was like he was breathing twice as much oxygen, had twice as much blood, had two hearts to drive the motion of his body. He put it down to the doubling magic of Parabatai. She made him twice what he would be otherwise. But he'd had to send her away with the kids. He didn't trust anyone else with them, and definitely not Arthur. Arthur, he thought bitterly, who was hiding in his attic while one of his nephews desperately tried to hold his family together, and another one. "Mark," Jillian said. The bedroom was dim, the curtains closed. He could just see that Christina was sitting on the floor, her back to the wall. She had one hand pressed to the pendant at her throat and the other at her hip, where something gleamed between her fingers. Mark was pacing back and forth at the foot of the bed, his hair hanging in his face. You could see how painfully thin he was. There was sinewy muscle on him, but it was the kind you got from starving sometimes and driving yourself anyway. His head jerked up when Julian said his name. Their eyes met, and for a brief moment Julian saw a flicker of recognition in his brother's eyes. "Mark," he said again and moved forward, his hand out. "It's me. It's Jules."
"Don't," Christina started up, but it was too late. Mark had bared his teeth in an angry hiss.
"Lies," he snarled. "Hallucinations. I know you. Gwyn sent you to trick me."
"I'm your brother," Julian said again. The look on Mark's face was wild.
"You know the wishes of my heart," said Mark, "and you turn them against me like knives."
Julian looked across the room at Christina. She was rising to her feet slowly, as if preparing to throw herself between the two brothers if needed. Mark whirled on Jules. His eyes were blind, unseeing.
"You bring the twins in front of me, and you kill them over and over. My Ty, he doesn't understand why I can't save him. You bring me Drew, and when she laughs and asks to see the fairy tale castle all ringed around with hedges, you throw her against the thorns until they pierce her small body. And you bid me wash in Octavian's blood, for the blood of an innocent child is magic under the hill."
Julian came no closer. He was remembering what Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild had told him and his sister, their meeting with Mark years ago under the fairy hills, his broken eyes and the whip marks on his body. Mark was strong, he had told himself in the dead darkness of the thousand nights afterward. He could endure it. Julian had thought about only torture of the body. He had not thought about torture of the mind.
"And Julian," Mark said, "he's too strong to break. You try to break him on the wheel and tear him with thorns and blades, but even then he won't give up, so you bring him to Emma, for the wishes of our hearts are knives to you."
That was too much for Julian. He lurched forward, grabbing hold of one of the posts of the bed to steady himself.
"Mark," he said, "Mark Anthony Blackthorne, please, it's not a dream. You're really here. You're home."
He reached for Mark's hand. Mark whipped it back, away from him.
"You are lying smoke. I'm your brother. I have no brothers and sisters, no family. I am alone. I ride with the wild hunt. I am loyal to Gwyn, the hunter."
Mark recited the words as if by rote. "I'm not Gwyn," said Julian. "I'm a Blackthorn. I have Blackthorn blood in me, just like you.
You are a phantom and a shadow. You are the cruelty of hope."
Mark turned his face away. "Why do you punish me? I've done nothing to displease the hunt."
"There's no punishment here."
Julian took a step closer to Mark. Mark didn't move, but his body trembled.
"This is home. I can prove it to you."
He glanced back over his shoulder. Christina was standing very still against the wall, and he could see that the gleam in her hand was a knife. Clearly, she was waiting to see if Mark would attack him. Julian wondered why she had been willing to stay in the room with Mark alone. Hadn't she been afraid?
"There is no proof," Mark whispered. "Not when you can weave any illusion before my eyes."
"I'm your brother," Julian repeated, "and to prove it to you, I'll tell you something only your brother would know." At that, Mark raised his eyes. Something flickered in them like a light shining on distant water.
"I remember the day you were taken," Julian said.
Mark recoiled. "Any of the folk would know about that. We were up in the training room. We heard noises, and you went downstairs. But before you went, you said something to me. Do you remember?" Mark stood very still.
"You said, 'Stay with Emma,'" Julian said. "You said to stay with her, and I have. We're Parabatai now. I've looked after her for years, and I always will, because you asked me to. Because it was the last thing you ever said to me. Because..."
He remembered then that Christina was there, and cut himself off abruptly. Mark was staring at him, silent. Julian felt despair well up inside him. Maybe this was a trick of the fairies. Maybe they had given Mark back, but so broken and hollowed out that he wasn't Mark anymore. Maybe... Mark nearly fell forward and threw his arms around Julian. Julian barely managed to catch himself before almost falling over. Mark was whipcord thin but strong, his hands fisting in Julian's shirt. Julian could feel Mark's heart hammering, feel the sharp bones under his skin. He smelled like earth and mildew and grass and nighttime air.
"Julian," Mark said, muffled, his body shaking. "Julian, my brother, my brother."
Somewhere in the distance, Julian heard the click of the bedroom door as it shut. Christina had left them alone together. Julian sighed. He wanted to relax into his older brother, let Mark hold him up the way he once had. But Mark was slighter than he was, fragile under his hands. He would be holding Mark up from now on. It was not what he had imagined, dreamed of, but it was the reality. It was his brother. He tightened his hands on Mark and adjusted his heart to bear the new burden. The library in the Los Angeles Institute was small. Nothing like the famous libraries of New York and London, but well known regardless for its surprisingly large collection of books in Greek and Latin. They had more books on the magic and the occultism of the classical period than the Institute in Vatican City. Once the library had been terracotta tile and mission windows, now it was a starkly modern room. The old library had been destroyed in Sebastian Morgenstern's attack on the Institute, the books scattered among bricks and desert. Rebuilt, it was glass and steel. The floor was polished mountain ash, smooth and shining with applications of protective spells. A spiral ramp began at the north side of the first floor and climbed the walls. The outer side of the ramp was lined with books and windows, while the inner, facing the library's interior, was a shoulder-high railing. At the very top was an oculus, a skylight held closed with a large copper lock, made of foot-thick glass decorated all over with protective runes. Maps were kept in a massive chest decorated with the crest of the Blackthorn family, a ring of thorns, with their family motto beneath it, Lex Mala, Lex Nulla. A bad law is no law. Emma suspected that the Blackthorns hadn't exactly always gotten along with the council. Drusilla was rummaging around in the map chest. Livy and Ty were at the table with more maps, and Tavi was playing under it with a set of plastic soldiers. "Can you tell if Julian's all right?" Livy asked, propping her chin on her hand to look at Emma anxiously. "You know, how he's feeling?" Emma shook her head. "Parabatai stuff isn't really like that. I mean, I can feel if he's hurt, physically, but not his emotions so much." Livy sighed. "It would be so great to have a parabatai." "I don't really see why," Ty said. "Someone who always has your back," said Livy. "Someone who will always protect you." "I would do that for you anyway," Ty said, pulling a map toward himself. This was an argument they'd had before. Emma had heard some variation of it half a dozen times. "Not everyone's cut out to have one," she said. She wished for a moment that she had the words to explain it properly, how loving someone more than you loved yourself gave you strength and courage, how seeing yourself in your parabatai's eyes meant seeing the best version of yourself, how at its best, fighting alongside your parabatai was like playing instruments in harmony with one another, each piece of the music improving the other. "Having someone who's sworn to shield you from danger," said Livy, her eyes shining. "Someone who would put their hands in a fire for you." Briefly, Emma remembered that Jem had once told her that his parabatai, Will, had thrust his hands into a fire to retrieve a packet of medicine that would save Jem's life. Maybe she shouldn't have repeated that story to Livy. "In the movies, Watson throws himself in front of Sherlock when there's gunfire," Ty said, looking thoughtful. "That's like parabatai." Livy looked mildly outfoxed, and Emma felt for her. If Livy said it wasn't like parabatai, Ty would argue. If she agreed it was, he would point out you didn't need to be parabatai to jump in front of someone when there was danger. He wasn't wrong, but she sympathized with Livy's desire to be parabatai with Ty, to make sure her brother was always by her side. "Got it," Drusilla announced suddenly. She stood up from rummaging around in the map chest with a long piece of parchment in her hands. Livy, abandoning the parabatai discussion, hurried over to help her carry it to the table. In a clear bowl, on the table center was a heap of sea glass the Blackthorns had collected over the years, lumps of milky blue, green, copper, and red. Emma and Ty used the blue glass to weigh down the edges of the ley line map. Tavi, now sitting on the edge of the table, had begun sorting the rest of the sea glass into piles by color. Emma let him. She didn't know how else to keep him distracted just now. "Ley lines," Emma said, running her index finger over the long black lines on the map. It was a map of Los Angeles that probably dated back to the 40s. Landmarks were visible under the ley lines. The Crossroads of the World in Hollywood, the Bullocks Building on Wilshire, the Angels Flight Railroad in Bunker Hill, the Santa Monica Pier, the never-changing curve of the coast and the ocean. All the bodies were left under the span of the ley line, but what Magna said is that there are places where all the ley lines converge. "What does that have to do with anything?" Livy asked, practical, as always. "I don't know. But I don't think you would have said it if it didn't matter. I imagine the place of convergence has some pretty powerful magic." As Ty applied himself to the map with renewed vigor, Christina came into the library and gestured for Emma to come talk to her. Emma slid off the table and followed Christina to the coffee maker by the window. It was witchlight powered, which meant there was always coffee, although the coffee wasn't always very good. "Is Julian all right?" Emma asked. "And Mark?" "They were talking when I left." Christina filled two cups with black coffee and dumped in sugar from a small enamel pot on the windowsill. Julian calmed him down. Julian could calm anyone down. Emma picked up a second cup of coffee, enjoying the warmth against her skin, though she didn't really like coffee and didn't tend to drink it. Besides, her stomach was tied in so many knots she didn't think she could force anything down. She walked back toward the table where the Blackthorns were arguing about the ley line map. "Well, I can't help it if it doesn't make sense," Ty was saying peevishly. "That's where it says the convergence is." "Where?" Emma asked, coming up behind him.
"Here."
Drew pointed at a circle Ty had sketched on the map in pencil. It was over the ocean, further out from Los Angeles than Catalina Island.
"So much for anyone doing magic there."
"Guess Magnus was just making conversation," said Livy.
"He probably didn't know," Emma began and broke off as the library door opened. It was Julian. He stepped into the room and then moved to the side, diffidently, like a conjurer presenting the result of a trick. Mark moved into the doorway after him. Julian must have gotten Mark's old things out of the storeroom. He was wearing jeans that were slightly short on him, probably a pair of his old ones, and one of Julian's t-shirts, heather gray and washed to a soft fadedness. In contrast, his hair looked very blonde, almost silvery. It hit his shoulders, looking slightly less tangled, as if he'd brushed the twigs out of it at least.
"Hello," he said.
His siblings looked at him in silent, wide-eyed astonishment.
"Mark wanted to see you," Julian said.
He reached around to ruffle the hair on the back of his neck, looking bemused, as if he had no idea what to do next.
"Thank you," Mark said, "for the gifts of welcome you gave me."
The Blackthorns continued to stare. Nobody moved except Tavi, who slowly laid his sea glass down on the table.
"The box," Mark clarified. "In my room."
Emma felt the coffee cup she was holding plucked out of her hand. She made an indignant noise, but Christina was already holding it, crossing the room, past the table and walking up to Mark, her back straight. She held out the mug.
"Do you want some?" she said.
Looking relieved, he took it. He lifted it to his mouth and swallowed, his whole family watching him in amazed fascination, as if he were doing something no one had ever done before. He grimaced. Moving away from Christina, he coughed and spit.
"What is that?"
"Coffee." Christina looked startled.
"It tastes of the most bitter poison," Mark said indignantly.
Livy suddenly giggled. The sound cut through the stillness of the rest of the room, the frozen tableau of the others.
"You used to love coffee," she said. "I remember that about you."
"I can't imagine why I would have. I've never tasted something so disgusting." Mark made a face.
Ty's eyes flicked between Julian and Livy. He looked eager and excited, his long fingers tapping at the table in front of him.
"He isn't used to coffee anymore," he said to Christina. "They don't have it in Fairy."
"Here." Livy stood up, scooping an apple from the table. "Have this instead." She went forward and held out the apple to her brother. Emma thought she looked like a latter-day Snow White, with her long dark hair and the apple in her pale hand.
"You don't mind apples, do you?"
"My thanks, gracious sister."
Mark bowed and took the apple, while Livy looked at him with her mouth partly open.
"You never call me gracious sister," she said, turning to Julian with an accusing look.
He grinned.
"I know you too well, Runt."
Mark reached up and drew the chain from around his throat. Dangling from the end of it was what looked like the head of an arrow. It was clear, as if made of glass, and Emma recalled having seen something like it in pictures Diana had showed them. Mark began to use the edge of it to peel his apple, matter-of-factly. Tavi, who had crawled under the table again and was looking out, made an interested noise. Mark glanced at him and winked. Tavi ducked back under the table, but Emma could see that he was smiling. She couldn't stop looking at Jules. She thought of the way he'd cleaned out Mark's room, hurling his brother's things savagely into a pile as if he could shatter the memories of him. It had lasted only a day, but there had been shadows in his eyes since. She wondered, if Mark stayed, would the shadows disappear?
"Did you like the presents?" Drew demanded, swiveling around on the table, her round face anxious.
"I put bread and butter in for you in case you were hungry."
"I did not know what all of them were," Mark said candidly.
The clothes were very useful. The black metal object.
That was my microscope, Ty said, looking at Julian for approval. I thought you might like it.
Julian leaned against the table. He didn't ask Ty why Mark would want a microscope, just smiled his sideways, gentle smile.
That was nice of you, Ty.
Tiberius wants to be a detective, Livy explained to Mark, like Sherlock Holmes.
Mark looked puzzled.
Is that someone we know, like a warlock?
He's a book character, Drew said, laughing.
I've got all the Sherlock Holmes books, said Ty. I know all the stories. There are 56 short stories and 4 novels. I can tell them to you, and I'll show you how to use the microscope.
I think I buttered it, Mark admitted, looking shamefaced. I did not remember it was a scientific tool.
Emma looked worriedly at Ty. He was meticulous about his things, and could be deeply upset by anyone touching them or moving them. But he didn't look angry. Something about Mark's candidness seemed to delight him, the way he sometimes was delighted by an unusual kind of demonic ichor or the life cycle of bees. Mark had cut his apple into careful pieces and was eating them slowly, in the manner of someone who was used to making what food they had last. He was quite thin, thinner than a shadow hunter his age would usually be. Shadow hunters were encouraged to eat and train, build their muscle and stamina. Most shadow hunters, due to the constant brutal physical training, ranged from wiry to muscular, though Drusilla was round-bodied, something that bothered her more the older she got. Emma always felt pain to see the blush that colored Drew's cheeks when the gear designated for girls in her age group didn't fit.
I heard you guys speak of convergences, Mark said, moving forward toward the others, carefully, as if unsure of his welcome.
His eyes lifted, and to Emma's surprise, he looked at Christina.
Convergence of ley lines is a place where dark magic can be done undetected. The fair folk know much of ley lines, and use them often.
He had slung his arrowhead back around his neck. It glimmered as he bent his head to look at the map on the table.
This is a map of ley lines in Los Angeles, said Christina. All the bodies have been found along them.
Wrong, Mark said, leaning forward.
No, she's right, Ty said with a frown. It is a map of ley lines, and the bodies have been dumped along them.
But the map is incorrect, Mark said. The lines are not accurate, nor are the points of convergence. His long-fingered right hand brushed over the pencil circle Ty had made.
This is not right at all. Who made this map?
Julian moved closer, and for a moment he and his brother were shoulder to shoulder, their pale hair and dark hair a startling contrast.
It's the Institute's map, I assume.
We took it from the trunk, Emma said, leaning over it from the opposite side of the table, with all the other maps.
Well, it has been tampered with, said Mark. We will need a correct one.
Maybe Diana could get us one, Julian said, reaching for a pad of paper and a pencil. Or we could ask Malcolm.
Or check out what's at the shadow market, said Emma, and grinned unrepentantly at Julian's look.
Just a suggestion.
Mark glanced at his brother, and then the others, clearly worried.
Was that helpful? He said.
Was it a thing I should not have said?
Are you sure? Said Ty, looking from the map to his brother, and something in his face was open as a door.
That the map is incorrect?
Mark nodded.
Then it was helpful, said Ty.
We could have wasted days on a map that was wrong, maybe longer.
Mark exhaled in relief.
Julian put his hand on Mark's back.
Livy and Drew beamed.
Tavi was looking out from under the table, clearly curious.
Emma glanced at Christina.
The blackthorns seemed to be wound together by a sort of invisible force. In that moment, they were completely a family, and Emma could not even mind that she and Christina were on the outside.
I could attempt to correct it, said Mark, but I do not know if I have the skill.
Helen could do it. He glanced at Julian.
She's married and away, but I assume she will return for this.
And to see me?
It was like watching glass shatter in slow motion.
None of the blackthorns moved, not even Tavi, but blankness spread over their features as they realized exactly how much it was that Mark did not know.
Mark paled and slowly set the core of his apple down on the table.
What is it?
Mark, Julian said, looking toward the door.
Come and talk to me in your room. Not here.
No, Mark interrupted, his voice rising with fear. You will tell me now. Where is my full-blood sister, the daughter of Lady Nerissa? Where is Helen?
There was an achingly awkward silence. Mark was looking at Julian,
They were no longer standing beside each other. Mark had moved away so quietly and quickly Emma had not seen it happen.
"You said she was alive," he said, and in his voice there was fear and accusation.
"She is," Emma hastened to say. "She's fine." Mark made an impatient noise.
"Then I would know where my sister is.
Julian?" But it wasn't Julian who answered.
"She was sent away when the cold piece was decided," Ty said, to Emma's surprise. He sounded matter-of-fact. "She was exiled."
"There was a vote," said Livy. "Some of the Clave wanted to kill her because of her fairy blood, but Magnus Bane defended the rights of downworlders. Helen was sent to Wrangle Island to study the wards."
Mark leaned against the table, his palm flat against it, as if he were trying to catch his breath after being punched.
"Wrangle Island," he whispered. "It is a cold place. Ice and snow. I've ridden over those lands with the hunt. I never knew my sister was down there, in among the frozen wastes."
"They would never have let you see her, even if you had known," Julian said.
"But you let her be sent away."
Mark's two colored eyes were flashing. "You let them exile her."
"We were children. I was 12 years old."
Julian didn't raise his voice. His blue eyes were flat and cold.
"We had no choice.
We talked to Helen every week. We petitioned the Clave every year for her return."
"Speech and petitions," Mark spat. "Might as well do nothing."
"I knew. I knew they had chosen not to come for me. I knew they had abandoned me to the wild hunt." He swallowed painfully. "I thought it was because they feared Gwyn and the vengeance of the hunt, not because they hated and despised me."
"It wasn't hate," said Julian. "It was fear."
"They said that we couldn't look for you," said Ty. He had taken one of his toys out of his pocket, a length of cord that he often ran through and under his fingers, bending and shaping it into figure eights. "That it was forbidden. It's forbidden to visit Helen, too."
Mark looked toward Julian, and his eyes were dark with anger, black and bronze.
"Did you even try?"
"I won't fight with you, Mark," Julian said. The side of his mouth was twitching. It was something that happened only when he was deeply upset, and something, Emma guessed, that only she would notice.
"You won't fight for me either," Mark said. "That much is clear." He glanced around the room. "I have come back to a world where I am not wanted, it seems," he said, and slammed his way out of the library.
There was an awful silence.
"I will go after him," Christina said, and darted from the room.
In the soundlessness left by her departure, the Blackthorns looked at Jules, and Emma fought the urge to run to put herself between him and his siblings, pleading eyes. They looked at him as if he could fix it, fix everything, as he always had. But Julian was standing very still, his eyes half closed, his hands twisted into fists. She remembered the way he had looked in the car, the desperation in his expression. There were few things in life that could undo Julian's calm, but Mark was and had always been one of them.
"It's going to be all right," Emma said, reaching out to pat Drew's soft arm.
"Of course he's angry. He's every right to be angry, but he's not angry at any of you." Emma stared over Drusilla's head at Julian, trying to catch his gaze, to steady him.
"It's going to be fine."
The door opened again, and Christina came back into the room. Julian turned his gaze toward her sharply. Christina's dark, glossy braids were coiled around her head. They shone as she shook her head.
"He's all right," she said, "but he has closed himself in his room, and I think it's best if we leave him alone.
I can wait in the corridor if you like." Julian shook his head.
"Thanks," he said, "but no one needs to keep watch on him. He's free to come and go."
"But what if he hurts himself?" It was Tavi, his voice small and thin. Julian bent down and lifted his brother up, arms around Tavi, hugging him tightly once before setting him down again. Tavi kept his hand fixed on Jules' shirt.
"He won't," Julian said.
"I want to go up to the studio," Tavi said. "I don't want to be here." Julian hesitated, then nodded. The studio where he painted was somewhere that he often brought Tavi when his little brother was frightened. Tavi found the paints, the papers, even the brushes soothing.
"I'll bring you up," he said. "There's leftover pizza in the kitchen if anyone wants it, and sandwiches and..."
"It's okay, Jules," Livy said. She had seated herself on the table by her twin. She was above Ty as he looked down at the ley line map, his mouth set.
"We can handle dinner. We'll be fine."
"I'll bring you up something to eat," Emma said. "And for Tavi, too."
"Thank you,"
Julian mouthed to her before he turned toward the door. Before he reached it, Ty, who had been quiet since Mark had left, spoke.
"You won't punish him," he said, his quirt wrapped tightly around the fingers of his left hand.
"Will you?"
Julian turned around, clearly surprised.
"Punish Mark? For what?"
"For all the things he said." Ty was flushed, unwinding the cord slowly as it slid through his fingers.
Over years of watching his brother and trying to learn, Julian had come to understand that where sounds and light were concerned, Ty was far more sensitive to them than most people. But where touch was concerned, it fascinated him. It was the way Julian had learned to create Ty's distractions and handholds, by watching him spend hours investigating the texture of silk or sandpaper, the corrugations of shells and the roughness of rocks.
They were true. They were the truth. He told us the truth, and he helped with the investigation. He shouldn't be punished for that.
Of course not, said Julian.
None of us would punish him. It's not his fault if he doesn't understand everything, Ty said. Or if things are too much for him, it's not his fault.
Ty, said Livy. It had been Emma's nickname for Tiberius when he was a baby. Since then, the whole family had adopted it. She reached to rub his shoulder.
It'll be all right.
I don't want Mark to leave again, Ty said. Do you understand, Julian? Emma watched as the weight of that, the responsibility of it, settled over Julian.
I understand, Ty, he said.
8. Out of the Cloud by Night. Emma shouldered open the door to Julian's studio, trying hard not to spill any liquid out of the 2 overflowing mugs of soup she was carrying. There were 2 rooms in Julian's studio, the one Julian let people see, and the one he didn't. His mother, Eleanor, had used the larger room as a studio and the smaller one as a darkroom to develop photographs. Ty had often voiced the question of whether the developing chemicals and setup were still intact, and whether he could use them. But the second studio room was the only issue in which Julian didn't bend to the will of his younger siblings or offer to give up what was his for them. The black-painted door stayed closed and locked, and even Emma wasn't allowed inside. Nor did she ask. Julian had so little privacy, she didn't want to begrudge him the bit he could claim. The main studio was beautiful. 2 of the walls were glass, one facing the ocean and one the desert. The other 2 walls were painted creamy taupe, and Julian's mother's canvases, abstracts and bright colors, still adorned them. Jules was standing by the central island, a massive block of granite whose surface was covered with sheafs of paper, boxes of watercolors, and piled tubes of paint with lyrical names. Alizarin red, cardinal purple, cadmium orange, ultramarine blue. He raised one hand and put a finger to his lips, glancing to the side. Seated at a small easel was Tavi, armed with a box of open non-toxic paints. He was smearing them over a long sheet of butcher paper, seeming pleased with his multicolored creation. There was orange paint in his brown curls.
I just got him calmed down, Julian said as Emma approached and set the mugs on the island.
What's going on? Has anyone talked to Mark?
His door is still locked, Emma said. The others are in the library. She pushed one of the mugs toward him.
Eat, she said. Christina made it, tortilla soup, although she says we have the wrong chilies.
Julian picked up a mug and knelt down to place it next to Tavi.
His little brother looked up and blinked at Emma, as if he'd just noticed she was there.
Did Jules show you the pictures? He demanded.
Blue had joined the orange and yellow in his hair. He looked like a sunset.
Which pictures? Emma asked as Julian straightened up.
The ones of us, the card ones. She raised an eyebrow at Jules.
The card what?
He flushed. Portraits, he said. I did them in the Rider-Waite style, like a tarot.
The mundane tarot? Emma said as Jules reached for a portfolio book.
Shadowhunters tended to eschew objects of mundane superstition. Palmistry, astrology, crystal balls, tarot cards. They weren't forbidden to own or touch, but they were associated with unsavory dwellers on the fringes of magic, like Johnny Rook.
I made some changes to it, Julian said, opening the book to show a flutter of papers, each sporting a colorful, distinctive illustration. There was Livy with her saber, hair flying, but instead of her name beneath, it read, The Protector. As always, Julian's painting seemed to reach out, a direct line to her heart, making her feel as if she understood what Julian had felt while he was painting. Looking at the picture of Livy, Emma felt a flash of admiration, love, a fear of loss, even
Julian would never speak of it, but she suspected he was watching Livy and Ty become adults with more than a little terror. Then there was Tiberius, a death's head moth fluttering on his hand, his pretty face turned down away from the viewer. The painting gave Emma a sense of fierce love, intelligence, and vulnerability mixed together. Beneath him it said, the genius. Then there was the dreamer, Drew with her head in a book, and the innocent, Tavi in his pajamas, sleepy, head cradled in his hand. The colors were warm, affectionate, caressing. And then there was Mark, arms crossed over his chest, hair as blonde as straw. He wore a shirt that bore the design of spread wings. Each wing sported an eye, one gold, one blue. A rope circled his ankle, trailing out of the frame. The prisoner, it said. Jules' shoulder brushed against Emma's as she leaned in to study the image. Like all Julian's drawings, it seemed to whisper to her in a silent language. Loss, it said, and sorrow, and years that you could not recapture.
Is this what you were working on in England? She asked.
Yes, I was hoping to do the whole set. He reached back and scrubbed at his tangled brown curls. I might have to change the title of Mark's card, said Julian, now that he's free.
If he stays free.
Emma brushed the drawing of Mark aside and saw that the next portrait was of Helen, standing among ice floes, her pale hair covered by a knitted cap. The separated, it said. There was another card, the devoted, for her wife, Aline, whose dark hair made a cloud around her. She wore the blackthorn ring on her hand. And the last was of Arthur, sitting at his desk. A red ribbon ran along the floor beneath him, the color of blood. There was no title. Julian reached out and shuffled them back into the notebook. They're not finished yet. Am I going to get a card? Emma teased. Or is it just blackthorns and blackthorns by marriage?
Why don't you draw Emma? Tavi asked, looking at his brother. You never draw Emma.
Emma saw Julian tense. It was true. Julian rarely drew people, but even when he did, he'd stopped sketching Emma years ago. The last time she remembered him drawing her was a family portrait at Aline and Helen's wedding.
Are you all right? She said, her voice low enough that she hoped Tavi couldn't hear.
He exhaled, hard, and opened his eyes, his muscles unclenching. His eyes met hers, and the curl of anger that had begun unfurling in her stomach vanished. His gaze was open, vulnerable.
I'm sorry, he said. It's just I always thought when he got back, when Mark got back, he'd help.
That he'd take over, take care of everything. I never thought he'd be something else I had to deal with. Emma was carried back in that moment to all the weeks, the months after Mark had first been taken and Helen sent away, when Julian had woken up screaming for the older brother and sister who weren't there, who would never be there again. She remembered the panic that sent him stumbling to the bathroom to throw up, the nights she'd held him on the cold tiled floor while he shook as if he had a fever. I can't, he'd said. I can't do this alone. I can't bring them up. I can't raise four children. Emma felt the anger uncurl in her stomach again, but this time it was directed at Mark.
Jules? Tavi asked, sounding nervous, and Julian passed a hand over his face.
It was a nervous habit, as if he were wiping an easel free of paint. When he dropped his hand, the fear and emotion had gone from his eyes. I'm here, he said, and went over to pick up Tavi. Tavi put his head down on Jules' shoulder, looking sleepy and getting paint all over Jules' shirt. But Jules didn't seem to care. He put his chin down in his younger brother's curls and smiled at Emma. Forget it, he said. I'm going to take this one off to bed. You should probably get some sleep, too. But Emma's veins were buzzing with a sharp elixir of anger and protectiveness. No one hurt Julian. No one. Not even his much-missed, much-loved brother. I will, she said. I've got something to do first. Julian looked alarmed. Emma, don't try to... But she was already gone. Emma stood in front of Mark's door, her hands on her hips.
Mark!
She rapped with her knuckles for the fifth time.
Mark Blackthorne, I know you're in there. Open the door!
Silence. Emma's curiosity and anger warred with her respect for Mark's privacy, and won. Opening runes didn't work on doors inside their institute, so she drew a thin knife from her belt and slid it into the gap between the door and the door jamb. The latch popped, and the door swung wide. Emma stuck her head in. The lights were on, curtains drawn against the darkness outside. The bed covers were rumpled, the bed empty. In fact, the whole room was empty. Mark wasn't there. Emma pulled the door shut and turned around with an exasperated sigh and almost screamed. Drew was standing behind her with wide, dark eyes. She was clutching a book to her chest.
Drew! You know, usually when people sneak up on me from behind, I stab them.
Emma exhaled shakily. Drew looked glum.
You're looking for Mark?
Emma saw no point in denying it.
True.
He's not in there, Drew said.
Also true. This is a big night for stating the obvious, huh?
Emma smiled at Drew, feeling a pang. The twins were so close, and Tavi so young and dependent on Jules. It was hard, she thought, for Drew to find the place she fit.
He'll be okay, you know.
He's on the roof, Drew said. Emma raised an eyebrow.
What makes you say that?
He always used to go up there when he was upset, said Drew. She glanced toward the window at the far end of the hall.
And up there, he'd be under the sky. He could see the hunt if they rode by.
Emma felt chilled.
They won't, she said. They won't ride by. They won't take him again.
Even if he wants to go?
Drew.
Go up there and bring him back down, Drusilla said.
Please, Emma.
Emma wondered if she looked bewildered. She felt bewildered.
Why me?
Because you're a pretty girl, said Drew, a little wistfully, looking down at her own round body. And boys do what pretty girls want. Great Aunt Marjorie said so. She said if I wasn't such a butterball, I'd be a pretty girl and boys would do what I wanted. Emma was appalled.
That old bat, sorry, said what?
Drew hugged the book more tightly to her.
You know, it doesn't sound so bad, does it? Butterball? Like you could be something cute, like a squirrel or a chipmunk.
You're much cuter than a chipmunk, Emma said. Weird teeth, and I have it on good authority that they speak in high, squeaky voices. She ruffled Drew's soft hair.
You're gorgeous, she said. You'll always be gorgeous. Now I'll go and see what I can do about your brother.
The hinges on the trapdoor that led to the roof hadn't been oiled in months. They squeaked loudly as Emma, bracing herself on the top rung of the ladder, shoved upward. The trapdoor gave way, and she crawled out onto the roof. She straightened up, shivering. The wind off the ocean was cold, and she had only thrown a cardigan on over her tank top and jeans. The shingle of the roof was rough under her bare feet. She had been up here too many times to count. The roof was flat, easy to walk on, only a slight slant at the edges where the shingles gave way to copper rain gutters. There was even a folding metal chair up here, where Julian sat sometimes when he painted. He'd gone through a whole phase of painting the sunset over the ocean. He'd given it up when he kept chasing the changing colors of the sky, convinced each stage of the setting sun was better than the one before, until every canvas ended up black. There was very little cover up here. It took only a moment to spot Mark, sitting on the edge of the roof with his legs dangling over the edge, staring out toward the ocean. Emma made her way over to him, the wind whipping her pale braids across her face. She pushed them away impatiently, wondering if Mark was ignoring her or if he was actually unaware of her approach. She stopped a few feet from him, remembering the way he'd hit out at Julian.
Mark, she said.
He turned his head slowly. In the moonlight, he was black and white. It was impossible to tell that his eyes were different colors. Emma Carstairs. Her full name. That wasn't very auspicious. She crossed her arms over her chest.
I came up here to bring you back down, she said. You're freaking out your family, and you're upsetting Jules.
Jules, he said carefully. Julian, your brother?
I want to talk to my sister, he said.
I want to talk to Helen.
Fine, said Emma. You can talk to her whenever. You can borrow an extra cell phone and call her, or we can have her call you. Or we can freaking Skype, if that's what you want.
We would have told you that before if you hadn't started yelling.
Skype?
Mark looked as if she'd sprouted several heads. It's a computer thing. Ty knows about it. You'll be able to look at her when you talk to her.
Like the scrying glass of the Fae?
Sort of like that.
Emma edged a little closer to him, as if she were sidling up to a wild animal that might spook at her approach.
Come back downstairs?
I prefer it here.
I was choking inside in all that dead air, crushed under the weight of all that building, roof and timbers and glass and stone. How do you live like that?
You did just fine for 16 years.
I barely remember, he said. It seems like a dream. He glanced back toward the ocean.
So much water, he said. I can see it and through it. I can see the demons down under the sea. I look at it and it doesn't seem real.
That was something Emma could understand. The sea was what had taken her parents' bodies and then returned them, broken and empty. She knew from the reports that they'd been dead when they'd been cast into the water, but it didn't help. She remembered the lines of a poem Arthur had recited once about the ocean. Water washes, and tall ships founder, and deep death waits. That was what the sea beyond the waves was to her. Deep death waiting.
Surely there's water in Faerie, she said.
Not any sea, and never enough water. The Wild Hunt would often ride for days without water. Only if we were fainting would Gwyn let us stop to drink. And there are fountains in the Wild of Faerie, but they run with blood.
For all the blood that's shed on earth runs through the springs of that country, said Emma.
I didn't realize that was literal.
I didn't realize you knew the old rhymes, said Mark, glancing over the first real interest he'd shown in her since his return.
The whole family has always tried to learn everything they can about Faerie, said Emma, sitting down beside him. Ever since we came back from the Dark War, Diana has taught us, and even the little ones wanted to know about the Fair Folk, because of you.
That must be a rather unpopular part of the Shadow Hunter curriculum, said Mark, considering recent history.
It isn't your fault what the Clave thinks of fairies, said Emma. You're a Shadow Hunter, and you were never part of the betrayal.
I'm a Shadow Hunter, Mark agreed. But I am part Fair Folk, too, like my sister. My mother was a Lady Nerissa. She died after I was born, and with no one to raise us, Helen and I were given back to our father. My mother was gentry, though, one of the highest rank of the Fae.
Did they treat you better in the hunt because of her?
Mark shook his head once.
I believe they think of my father as responsible for her death, for breaking her heart by leaving her. That did not dispose them well toward me.
He tucked a lock of pale hair behind his ear.
Nothing the Fair Folk did to my body or mind was as cruel as the moment I was told that the Clave would not be coming to find me, that they would send no rescue parties. Jace told me when he saw me in Faerie, "Show them what a Shadow Hunter is made of."
But what are Shadow Hunters made of if they desert their own?
The Council isn't all Shadow Hunters in the world, said Emma. A lot of Nephilim thought what was done to you was wrong, and Julia never stopped trying to get the Clave to change their minds.
She considered reaching to pat his arm, then thought better of it. There was still something a little feral about him. It would have been like reaching to pat a leopard.
You'll see, now that you're home.
Am I home? Asked Mark.
He shook his head like a dog shaking off water.
Perhaps I was unfair to my brother, he said. Perhaps I should not have lashed out. I feel like I'm in a dream.
It seems weeks ago they came to me at the hunt and told me I was to go back to the world.
Did they tell you that you'd be coming home?
No, he said.
They told me I had no choice but to leave the hunt, that the king of the Unseelie Court had commanded it. They pulled me down from my horse and bound my hands. We rode for days. They gave me something to drink, something that made me hallucinate and imagine things that were not there.
He looked down at his hands.
It was so I would not be able to find my way back, but I wish they had not done it, he said. I wish I could have arrived here as I have been for years, a capable member of the hunt. I would have liked my brothers and sisters to see me standing tall and proud, not fearful and crawling.
You do seem very different now, Emma said.
It was true. He seemed like someone who had woken up after 100 years of sleep, shaking the dust of a century's dreams from his feet. He had been terrified. Now his hands were steady, his expression somber.
Suddenly he smiled wryly. When they ordered me to reveal myself in the sanctuary, I thought it was another dream.
A good dream?
Emma said.
He hesitated, then shook his head.
In the early days of the hunt, when I disobeyed, I was made to see dreams, horrors, visions of my family dying. I thought that was what I was meant to be seeing again. I was terrified, not for myself, but for Julian.
But now you know it's not a dream, seeing your family, your home.
Emma, stop. He squeezed his eyes shut as if in pain. I can say this to you because you're not a Blackthorn. You do not have Blackthorn blood running through your veins. I have been in the land of Faerie for years.
and it is a place where immortal blood is turned to fire.